My name is Pastor Paul Jaley. I'm an historian in Plymouth. I've been studying the Pilgrim story and aspects about the Pilgrims since the 1970s, about 1976, 77. I write articles. I'm also the president of the Plymouth Rock Foundation, as well as a pastor of the church, which was a foundation started in 1970 for the express purpose of preserving the primary source documents of the Pilgrims because they're hardly taught on anymore. And we're just going to take one aspect of it, and that's their economics, how they learned lessons about economics and how to work on the market. So let's just ask God for a little insight today as we talk about these things, and I pray that it'll be helpful, some confirming to you, and others maybe pique your interest. So God, we just ask you for your spirit to work here. I thank you for each student here. You have a calling on their life. You have a destiny for them. I pray that the things we talk about, Lord, can be clear, especially in light of what's happening today. So God, I thank you, ask your blessing on this class now in Jesus' name, amen. So we're going to talk about Pilgrim economics, and basically we're going to do a little bit of background on economics itself. And I want to read to you just one verse from the book of Genesis, and I want to just share one thing with the Garden of Eden. I'll tell you just a few things as we begin. You probably know this, but just about any topic of any kind, what the Bible says about that topic begins in Genesis. Genesis is the book of beginnings. It's the seed form of principles, key principles. Now there are seven principles I know you emphasize in this school. I'm going to list them for you here on the slide. With the Garden of Eden, they may be a little different names. They come closer to the transliteration of the Hebrew in Genesis chapter 2. And there are approximately seven major commands, laws, principles that God spoke to Adam and Eve in the garden. When you apply them to any topic, you can get a little glimpse of what it might have been like in the Garden of Eden that God began to set up how everything would work. And I want to just highlight it with this. This is just part of it, but in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 16, it says, "The Lord commanded the man, saying, 'Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat it, for in the day you eat it you shall surely die.'" Now I'm picking that part for two reasons. One, I like to summarize. I'm a teacher. I teach high school on a regular basis. I've taught 7th grade to 12th grade for more than 40 years, so I recognize where you may be coming from. I've also been teaching these things to high school students for many decades. So I'm going to try to summarize. If you were to make some notes on this, I would say the following from that verse alone. Of all the trees in the garden, you may freely eat. Now the word freely in Hebrew is a word for liberty, and not only is it for liberty, but it's the word from which we get gratis or gratuity. What's a gratuity? If you go to a restaurant, you're expected to give a gratuity. What is that? What's another word you know for it? A tip. You're going to leave a tip. Gratuity is something you give above and beyond what you owe, right? It's grace. It's a synonym in Hebrew for the word grace in the New Testament. But the idea is simply this. God, when he put them in the garden, and we assume, and we have right to assume it scripturally, that whatever God said to Adam, he was going to share with Eve. Because the scriptures are pretty clear that the two of them were held accountable to the same things. So he said, I'm going to put you in the garden, and in that garden of all the trees except one, you are free to eat. So let me ask you this question. Which was greater in the Garden of Eden, liberty or restrictions? Why liberty? Because there's only one tree you couldn't eat from, but how many could you eat from? All the rest. So the first law God gave was a law of liberty, wasn't it? And the Garden of Eden is the very first place that God puts the first two of his creation, Adam and Eve, in that garden. Now, we could look at this from the standpoint of law. I begin my constitutional law courses where I go line by line through our state constitution, federal constitution. I begin in the Garden of Eden. And we look at the Garden of Eden as a society under law, the law of liberty. But we don't have to just deal with law. We can deal with virtually any area of life. You can teach on family life in the Garden of Eden. You can teach on a lot of topics. We're going to focus on economics. And in economics, it means that there's a free market. There's a free flow of work and habits that take place. Now, what I'm going to do is just, let's look at these for just a moment. If I look at this and the word, now this is in the order of the Hebrew words that are given in Genesis chapter 2, between verse 15 and 25, that are given to Adam. And if we reduce the verbs, the actions that are asked of Adam in the Garden of Eden, we come up with the following, and we can see what happens, how it's applied to economics. So here they are, and they are in the Garden of Eden. And this is the very first, the world's first, private property. In fact, it's quite obvious that they were responsible to take care of that piece of real estate. We don't know how large it was. Under Saddam Hussein, he was trying to identify where the Garden of Eden was. He was also rebuilding the Tower of Babel. He was doing all kinds of things in Iraq. And we recognize that there are no ways to archaeologically discover probably the Garden of Eden. And the main reason for that, of course, is the flood. But the point is, when you look at this, just take a quick survey. Labor, meaning labor was given to Adam and Eve as a verb before the fall, which means labor is not sinful. Labor is what we're called to do. That we call the principle of Christian character. You know it best as Christian character. Christian character means you are often judged by your work ethic. So most people, if you go to get a job someplace and your boss talks to you and says, hey, listen, and I go and I talk to them, you're normally characterized by your boss based on how you work. Would you agree? I mean, they know if you milk the brakes, if you come back early, if you take responsibility, if you have to be told constantly to do those things, they know. Your reputation, your character, is most closely tied to your work ethic. Same would be true in a classroom. Teachers know you by how much effort you put into a homework assignment. I've corrected hundreds and thousands of essays, research papers over the years, and I can tell you the essays I get back and I'm going through at night and I'm correcting those essays, let me tell you, there are essays that are perfect as far as the knowledge, but I can tell by the penmanship, by how the sentence structure is, not much effort. And the effort would be critical because labor, what is called labor theory in economics, deals with character. And you'll learn, if you're not only in there today, there's two forms of scarcity in the world. Most people think scarcity only refers to what you don't have enough of. But the primary thing that's scarce that causes poverty in nations is an unwillingness to work. That's the number one scarce commodity. If people are willing to work, you can ethic proof your job. You know, when you get a job somewhere, hey, hard times could be coming. We know all the stuff that's going on now. It's pretty crazy. But you want to be the last person fired. You know what I mean? You want to be the last one standing that boss would never want to get rid of. That means you can help yourself, you can help other people the farthest you can. And you can do that with your work ethic, your Christian character. Management. It's the word for manage, to keep the garden, to till the garden, to keep the garden, to maintain it. Management is synonymous with stewardship. We call it conscience is the most sacred what? Property, because conscience is internal property. It's where you put your priorities. If you're a conscientious person, you pay attention to what you do. They were to be conscientious in the garden. That Hebrew word literally means hedge the garden about in different sections and then manage it. You can't just till a whole garden. You have to till it row by row, right? One step at a time. You've got to be able to work it that way. And so that's what management is. It's guarding your conscience, guarding your integrity on the inside. That'll be reflected on the outside. Liberty, freedom to choose. If there was one word that would summarize economics, It's choice. You could write it down. It is choice is what you could say is the summary. I would ask my students, if you can summarize economics in one sentence, what would it be? It would be the freedom to choose what I buy or sell and live with its consequences. It's the freedom to both buy and live with the consequences or sell. Anytime government takes away your freedom to buy or sell or takes away your freedom to experience the consequences, we got a problem. And that's introduced in the garden. You're free to choose. Let me ask you this question. When they ate of the wrong tree, the only one they were told not to eat from, come on, you got a ton of choices that are positive and you go for the one that's there. When they did that, was there a government program that kept them from being kicked out of the garden? No. Did they experience the consequences? Yes, they did. And God did that because that's the way He operates. He wants us to learn. We learn from the fruit of our own doing, as the scripture says. So you have that idea of freedom to choose, the liberty, the law of liberty. We look at consequences, which we know how the seed of local self-government is planted is the way the principle sometimes is phrased. But the idea is sowing and reaping. You have the freedom to deal with the consequences, the freedom to fail. It's a very important freedom. I say to my students when I get to the start of the year, I'd say this, I love freedom and I want you to be free. You are free to do your homework and you are free not to do your homework. You are free to refuse to even pay attention. You're free to try to sleep. Now, you won't get too far, but you can try to sleep, especially early afternoon. That's a possibility. Now, because of all restrictions today, I can't walk up and explain it. But what I would normally do, if a student's sleeping in my class, I keep moving as I'm teaching. And I go over close to where the student is that's sleeping, and then I have my loudest point. You know, do you really think I do that? Yeah, probably. But I won't do that. The thing is this. You have all of these principles that you teach. Planning. We learn to plan with God. It's the principle of God's sovereignty and His plan for us. It's sometimes termed as the Christian form of our government, which is the external part. But the planning, which God did with Adam. He said, it's not good that you be alone, Adam. He wouldn't have thought of that unless God told him. Then He brought forth all the animals in pairs in front of him. So here's my plan. That's the executive, that's the legislative. And then here, now that you're going to be the judge, Adam, what do you think? Nope, I don't want to marry any of this. Okay, fine. Then we execute the plan. The executive. You have all three branches right in the Hebrew in Genesis chapter 2. And how about categorizing, bringing order out of it? We call that individuality. That He named the animals according to their similarities and their differences. He categorized them. And basically, from that, we get lots of the categorizations in science of God's creation. And voluntary covenant, of course, the family business, if we think of economics, the idea of covenant or voluntary union. So you have these principles right in the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden was an economic paradise. It was a place where they freely chose what they were going to work on. Now, folks, I don't know any more than you do, but many theologians have asked this question. How long did they work in the garden before they fell? Did they have 2 hours of freedom? 2 minutes of freedom? I mean, did they just turn around after God puts them in there? Adam and Eve get married. God is the minister. He brings them forward. They say their vows. They get married. They're in the Garden of Eden. They're under a law of a covenant. And do they walk down the path? And all of a sudden, in the tree they're not supposed to eat of, there's a snake very enticingly saying, did God really say? I don't think it was 2 minutes, but neither do I think it was long. Probably no more than 2 or 3 days, maybe a week. We don't know. But very quickly, they fell. When they fell, you have to understand now, we now live in a fallen economic world. No longer the paradise. So now all of these things they decay. They become warped. They become corrupted. Now, you know it as well as I do that the last thing you know, if you ask somebody if they want to become a Christian, most people's reaction is, are you kidding me? I would never serve your God. He's just a God of rules. You ever heard that? Because people's perspective now is the exact opposite, isn't it, of the Garden of Eden. And yet, still, there's far more God has for you to do than he wants to refrain you from. And so you have this Garden of Eden. Now, if that's the case, and we can summarize it by the freedom to choose, here I think this should be familiar to some of you. Let's take a look at what God did. In the Garden of Eden, and this is Charles Wolfe's little diagram, and some of you have probably seen this, and the following is this economic freedom formula. And look, this summarizes what they were able to do in the Garden of Eden. You have natural resources. So there were a lot of natural resources God gave. And of course, the original one, he's thinking of the Garden of Eden. We have a tree. But it could be all kinds of things. You have natural resources that God has made for you. You don't have to go out and make the natural resources. God has them for you. Plus what? Human energy. So you have to be. You have to want to work. You can't just say, oh, orange, would you jump off the tree into my mouth? Would you please do all the work for me? Book of Proverbs says the same thing. A slothful man is one who's not even willing to bring the food to his mouth. You want God to do that. God's not going to do that because that's not the way he's operating with us. Human energy, but it really multiplies by what? Tools. Have you ever thought about this? Okay. The difference, of course, between animals and humans, much of it is what? Our hands. Because our hands are made to use tools. Now, tools can be all kinds of, could be as simple as a hammer. But think, if you had to pound a nail in with your fist, as opposed to a hammer, we'd have some problems, wouldn't we? Immediately you'd say, well, I got to put something on my hand. I got to put something with a metal plate on the bottom of my hand here, so I'm not just punching holes through my wrist. That's crazy. Because tools multiply your effectiveness. If they garden their entire life with their hands, imagine making a row. Now, before sin, they didn't have to weed. But they did have to work the soil. They'd have to turn the soil over. They had to do that. But still, if you'd had no tools, do you agree? Take much longer, wouldn't it, to get it done? Much longer. Tools speed up the process, make you more productive in many ways, from the simple machines. And we think that there's great evidence based on what Genesis talks about in Genesis 4 and in the years that go by, that great ingenuity and productivity began to come in the garden. And they made tools. And the Bible tells us a little bit later on what kind of tools, and iron and all those kinds, even musical instruments that were made. But you see, you realize this produces your material welfare. This was the productivity of the garden. This was an economic freedom formula or an economic paradise. The individual was free, but never totally free. You are never absolutely free because there is a God. So if you were on an island, you're all by yourself, and there's nobody else on the island, you checked it out. There's nobody there. You might say, I'm free to do whatever I want. But you're wrong if you think nobody else is there, because God is there. And God's ultimate sovereignty is still over that island, even though you're all by yourself. He sees exactly what you're doing, and he can intervene at any moment. And if he doesn't intervene, he'll simply let you eat the fruit of your doings. And you will go downhill in many ways, inside, outside, everything else. So we know that God, that law of God is everywhere at the same time. It doesn't have to be revealed. It does not have to be written. It is always there. It's in every fiber of the universe because God is the creator. And so that is the key. By the way, if you ever want to witness to someone about the Lord, one of the first things you want to be able to do to witness is to ask someone whether they believe they're created by God. Is God your creator? And it'll be interesting because we have fewer and fewer people who even believe that today in our culture. But you need to know God as creator probably before you're going to know him as Redeemer, Christ. And those two things were very clear to those who framed the United States. So here you have this economic freedom formula, and the economic freedom formula has nothing to do. In other words, there's nothing in the economic freedom formula for civil government to do. Is there? No. Who was the civil government in the Garden of Eden? Who was the policeman with the gun? God. There was no other human being. It was God. God talked to Adam and Eve, right? God just asked him a question. Where are you? Do you think he didn't know? No, he knew. They didn't know. He's trying to awaken them. God was there. God was the civil government all the way up until Genesis 9, right after the flood. So this is huge. Now here's another aspect, another chart that's probably interesting too. And that is that you have the following. When sin came into the world, the things that we wanted got bigger. The limiting of what we want got smaller. For instance, if you are not thinking of God in any way, you just want more and more stuff. There are people who just can't stop buying stuff. That's what they want. And you think it's going to bring you happiness, and it doesn't. See, in a Christian society, you would be able to, you'd have more and more people who limit their wants, and therefore, what they do, they maximize their inputs and outputs. For instance, here, you have minimum inputs because you're going to have, if you are so insatiably desired to get everything, you're not going to be as productive. Whereas if you limit that, you're going to be more productive. So you see, Christianity has a great deal to do with an economic system. The more Christianity diffuses in an economy, in a society or an economy, the more there will be self-regulation. People will regulate themselves. They won't steal. Do you know businesses today? Report. Okay, if you've got their spreadsheet, let's say Walmart spreadsheet. So here's Walmart, massive, multi-million dollar, billion dollar company. All right, Walmarts are everywhere, would you agree? They're everywhere, not just in this country, okay? They're everywhere. Now, a Walmart is there and you say, well, let me just look at your expense sheet. You look at the expense, they usually have percentages against them. You know the largest percentage, the biggest line item, they say, category?
Loss prevention?
Yeah, in other words, their own employees stealing from them. That's the biggest line item they have to deal with. Now, let me ask you this question. Would you agree it's a big loss, isn't it? Would you also agree it shouldn't be? There's always going to be people on the outside stealing, but if people from the inside steal, that's even worse. They got the keys. They know where they're going. That's ridiculous. Let me ask you this question. If Christianity, which is the only religion ever in existence throughout world history, that controls you from within. You know that? No other religion promises to control you from within. So if Christianity comes into a business, guess what? Should that line item shrink? Yes, it should shrink. It should shrink naturally. Because now people are saying, hey, let's do it. You know what I teach? If the kids in my school are working, they're working for companies and businesses, I tell them this. I said, you know what? Every now and then, when you see your boss, no matter where you work, supermarket, stocking shelves, selling something, always remember at least once a week, at least once a month, pray about it. You need to go to your boss and say this. I really believe God has put me here to work for you so that I can make you successful and make you wealthy and make sure this company is around to hire others. I just thank you for the job that I have. Now, if you did that, there are managers that would be taken out on a stretcher. You know what I mean? They'd be like, oh my gosh. How often do you think that's said to a manager? How about an owner of a business? No, because the Marxist idea, the opposite is they're ripping everybody off. But the actual truth is they gave you a job. And so that's the kind of thing that happens with this. Our desires, our productivity, our output, it becomes much greater. You know, when I first started working, my father made a deal with me that he would pay half my college tuition if I paid the other half. But I had to save up before I went to college to be good with the deal. You got me? If I didn't produce the character to work extra time, not spend my money, save it, so there's money in the bank, he said, I'm not going to put money into you going to college when you have no work ethic to do anything with it. So that's great. It gave me a challenge. So you know what I did? I got a good job. Scouring heels on shoes. And literally, you had to push them into the machine at that time, scours the bottom of the heels, and you'd fill buckets all day long. And I worked 16-hour days in the summer because I got 8 hours of overtime. And so I'm padding my savings account to make good on my deal, okay? And I'm doing this, and all of a sudden one day, tell you the truth, I'm thinking I am really tearing through this thing. All of a sudden, I got a tap on my shoulder. I'm so intense on what I'm doing at my machine. I look around, there's 12 guys, big guys. I'm fairly big, but back then I was real skinny. I was a basketball player. These 12 guys, and they weren't looking happy at me at all. So I stopped my machine wondering, what's happened? One guy said, hey, you, if you know what's good for you, work slower. And do not work as well. We have been working here for 5 years. We've gotten the boss to think that we can only produce a certain amount of heels a day. Got it? And if you keep doing what you're doing, he's going to get the idea that we could do that. Tone it down, buddy, if you know what's good for you. Well, I mean, that was like, I wasn't expecting that. I had to talk that one over with my father. What should I do? Because he had pumped into me work ethic. Because you see, that's what happens. If one person starts being productive, it automatically raises the standard, doesn't it? Whereas if all they agreed, hey, we're only going to put out a certain number of boxes, he's not going to fire all of us. You see, that's what work ethic does. And it shines. It's a blessing to me when I go to some business in my hometown in Plymouth, and they said to me, hey, does so-and-so go to your school? And of course, I want to say, why? What do you want to say about him? I'll tell you if he does or doesn't. But he goes, no, that kid, if I could clone him, I'd hire 50 of that kid because of the work ethic that he has. Oh, yeah, he goes to the school. But anyway, the point is, that's a real blessing when that happens. Well, let's go on. So now, you realize in the Garden of Eden now is this amazing engine of productivity. Now, I'm going to skip ahead. I want to now talk about the pilgrims, the atmosphere the pilgrims had. Now, they started to research the Bible. They knew the Garden of Eden as well. But I want you to let's go into the medieval world of economics for a moment. Because of sin, when people are not given the challenge to work and be productive, often it's the government, it's state that moves in. And so the economic system was very mixed that was in England at the time of the pilgrims. It had gone downhill. We had about a 75 to 80% free market under King Alfred, which was the peak of Christian England by 900 AD in his common law. And there was it probably would have continued if King Alfred hadn't died. It probably would have continued on. But after that, England began to be run over, and especially after the Norman conquest in 1066. Now the practices of medieval Europe that were dominating in France and Spain and Italy come rushing in to England. And it changes things. That's why the Saxons, who retained the original Saxon, original English understanding under King Alfred, went underground. And the French ended up simply taking over their castles. Ivanhoe? Anybody read Ivanhoe? Oh, what a book, huh? I would teach Ivanhoe. Oh, anyway, I love teaching Ivanhoe. Here's the point. Here's what happened in Puritan England, even when at the time the pilgrims were coming over. First of all, the preachers were preaching against profit incentive. Let me tell you what that means. A preacher would get up and he would say the following. The Bible makes it clear that people are selfish due to sin. Correct? Yes. People only want to be greedy and have things for themselves. Yeah, that's true. Therefore, if you run a business, you should never try to make much of a profit. Only gain the profit whereby you can just barely stay in business. Otherwise, you are a greedy soul and you are a terrible person to do that. They would preach these sermons, hundreds, thousands of sermons against the profit motive preached in congregations in England and in New England during the 1600s. Now, they also had, to help us, sumptuary laws. Now, these were laws in Puritan New England. The government had laws on what fashions you could wear and what you couldn't wear. So governments had laws on all kinds of clothing, not just on the standard of modesty, but on the actual fashions. So governments set the fashions and the clothing industry. It was not a free market in clothing. And we might say, oh, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is then everything is set by government. Whatever the state says is fashionable, is fashionable. They had on food. They said, look, here's the problem. Some people eat too much. Have you ever eaten too much? And if you make a habit of it, you got a problem, right? But if you eat too much, is it the government's role? The government then said they would place fines for people who ate too much. There are government rules on what to eat and not to eat. There are government rules on tobacco, whether you could grow it, how much you could smoke, all that kind of stuff. There were government laws on liquor. Now, drunkenness would be supported by the scriptures for the sake of others. And they had government on leisure, how much vacation you could spend. You can't do too much now. You can't be too happy. You get too happy, government gets upset. All these laws. Because this was this law of the atmosphere that was against this. But with a heart change in motive, you can make a profit to serve. Wouldn't you agree the other half of that sermon wasn't preached? If you truly want to serve others, you should make a profit in order to hire more people, right? Not just make a profit so you can get 4 jets, 6 ocean liners, and that you're never going to use, and just be a greedy capitalist. No, the idea would be, now you're in a place where you serve. Also, a second thing is, this was set by the state at the time. Now, this was very common in England. It was the just price set by the state. It was regulate supply. You have supply and demand. So if I make tires, is that supply or demand? Supply. Now, if I make a lot of tires, but nobody wants to buy the tires, do I have a problem? But what I could do is pass a law that you have to buy my tires. Wouldn't that be the solution? No, not a good one. But the idea is I have all these tires. See, here's what happens. Demand and supply should work together freely. The guy who makes all those tires, what happens if people don't buy tires in that town? He starts making what? Less of them, maybe charging a bit more for them because there's a free market. All of a sudden, there becomes a demand. During COVID, I don't know if you've noticed this, many businesses have gone away. However, other businesses have made a killing. And the private market was so innovative during COVID. I know them because I know that I would go and talk to them. I've seen managers of restaurants be the most creative to follow the guidelines and where they put their tables. One guy rearranged his entire, I went to visit him because I said, every time I've gone to that restaurant, you're so packed, you hardly have any room to move. I said, how's this guy going to even make it? So I went and talked to him. He had the whole thing rearranged. He had his measuring stick out. He's so creative to get almost the same number of people. And he goes, I'm beating the system. Because innovation will do it. But in Puritan England and New England, just like the medieval guild system, the state licensed and forced inspection of products. And there, you can go to old books. I don't have them on my computer right now, but you can go to old books that will give you a whole sheet of paper, and it will say, by the state, saying, this is how much a wheel for a wagon costs. This is how much an axle costs. This is how much an ox costs. This is how much, if you're going to buy sheep, this is how much the sheep. The state set the prices. Is that price control? Yes. But not only that, the price of products were set, but there was a wage ceiling in medieval Europe as well, which was a minimum wage, plus the margin of profit was set by the government. So if you were going to work for a company, I suppose you're going to be a blacksmith. If you're going to be a blacksmith, the blacksmith's pay was set by the state. So if you want to be a blacksmith, you already know what you're going to be paid. Do you see any problems with this? In other words, do you think everyone will work just as hard? No, because their wage is set by the government because the government says we can't trust people's profit motive. Do you follow me? Since we can't trust it, but what's the alternative? We can trust the government's profit motive. I don't know if that proves true. It doesn't prove true in history. But the idea is you had wage ceiling. Now, would it be shocking to you to say that if you know, I mean, when I taught history, when world history, I wrote a course for our school in world history, and so we studied the Communist Manifesto. We studied the Humanist Manifestos. And you know, when Karl Marx puts in one of his 10 planks, when he sets it in, not only does he set in education laws and everything else, but implied in there are minimum wage laws. On laws of minimum wage of what it makes to survive. That the state must have it. But let me ask you this question. Let's think real quickly here. If the state sets what you have to pay the worker, right? Suppose you own a business. You own an ironwork, because we'll talk about the ironworks in a minute. We want an ironwork. You have to mine the iron out of bogs. You have to mine it out of the earth. It's a lot of work to do it. But if I have to pay you a minimum amount, everybody with me? Actually, I can't even pay you a maximum. I have to pay you what the state says. Not only that, do I have any freedom on what I can sell the iron for? No. And the government says the little margin between what you have to pay and what you can sell the product for gives you a very small margin there. And that before any expenses. Some cases they said 30%. Not that you have a 30%. That would be great for any company. But we're talking about, well, you have to still add all your other expenses. It came out to, 1%, 1.5% margin of some kind, there I have. Now, if I look at, that means I got to have a certain amount of people buy iron, right? Or I'm out of business. It's done. It's over with. I can't survive. So they had a big problem in England, not just among the Puritans, in the English society, and among the Puritans in New England, there was a big problem, and this was the problem. Often, we had what we called recycled business. People try going into business, what happens? They can't make a profit. Because they can't make a profit, because the government's controlling supply and demand, they go out of business. So then their children try it. Then the grandchildren try it. Because they gotta eat, they gotta survive somehow. And we had these recycled businesses which would kill multi-generational legacies among families. And this was a major problem. So I want to be simple here. Do you understand if the government sets the price for the iPhone? So the government sets the price for the iPhone. Can't be less, can't be more. Then the government sets the price for the people who manage and work on and maintain the iPhones and the electronics in the electronic field today. And there's only a tiny amount. First of all, do you realize that there will be very few variety? Would you agree? Now, everybody's out. It's going to be pretty much the same for everybody. How about innovation? Would there be a new iPhone coming out every 16 months? No. It would be pretty much the same thing. Probably not much innovation on color either. The products become monotone in that. And not only that, the tech industries would not be growing like they're growing right now. And so, do you see what I'm saying? This was the context. When the pilgrims were in England, reasoning from the scriptures and going to come to the New World, before they sailed on the Mayflower, they knew all this stuff. This was their life. And when you ask a Puritan theologian, what do you think about the economic? The last thing we're worried about is economics. It's one of the last things to be reformed in a nation. And the pilgrims, however, paid close attention to it. Now, I'll tell you why, because they realized this. If they went to the wilderness, now they had the advantage. They saw Jamestown. Was Jamestown successful? Economically, I'm talking about. Or did they have to have constant ships bringing them supplies every year? In other words, they lost money every year. It was a drain on England. Now, if you're constantly pumping money into a system like that, are more people going to go? Are they going to go to Jamestown if it's going to lose all that money? No, they're going to go, no way, I'm not going there. They're not going to keep, they're going to go, meaning leave. That's right, they're going to leave the place. Couldn't do it. So this was their context, and the pilgrims wanted to do something different. So let's just look at the charter for a minute. King James was so preoccupied with his wars, his women, his anger toward the reformers. He didn't really care about planting colonies. But Spain was planting them, Portugal was planting them, Italy was planting them, and they were, in a sense, England was losing the market. Edwin Sandys Sir Edwin Sandys and Richard Hakluyt said to the king, "This Western discovery will be greatly for the enlargement of the gospel of Christ." They went to him and said, "Look, all of the European countries are replicating societies in the wilderness just like they are. They're replicating their church, their economic system, everything there." Now, they had to be very careful because they're dealing with King James and he's a fanatic. So they had to appeal to his Christian training and said, "Listen, England will be unique. If England gets into the marketplace of world exploration and we start some colonies, they're going to be unique. They'll be so different from all the other ones, they will be more successful. Because they'll be Protestant, number one, that's different. And number two, the freedom for the gospel to be shared will be greater." They appealed to King James' lust for prominence and then said, "But you should allow freedom for it to be successful." Because Richard Hakluyt, Sir Edwin Sandys, they were Christians and they were in Parliament and they had access to the king. So England plants Protestant plantations with a Christian mission. Did you think King James wrote it? No, he didn't write it. But these guys wrote it. They said, "Propagate the Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God." That was the goal of the 1606 charter. And their rights were as if they were abiding in England. This, no other nation did this. See, if you were going to explore and you were from Spain, once you got on the boat and started sailing on the ocean, you were sailing away from your rights. Your rights came from the crown. The farther you go from the crown, the farther you go from your rights. Because you have to get the government. And how can you get the crown to save you over in some part of the world? It's not going to happen. England did something unique. It was because of the Christians who were salt and light in the Parliament. They wrote it into the charter. They said that your rights went with you. Do you have a right to life? Mm-hmm. You have a right to self-government? Yes. You have the right to representation over taxes? Yes. All these rights that you have, and the 1600s, basically, the origin of that was the Magna Carta at the time. And they said, and King Alfred's England, actually, and the Magna Carta was simply restoring part of those rights. But the idea was this: you have rights going with you. So you have the right of freedom, even when you get to the wilderness. You have the right of liberty. And so more people would go on the, do you follow me? More people are going to go if they have those rights. Now, here's what happens. The wealthy merchants decide, wow, he's going to set up competition. This is what King James did, folks. They had what is called, look at the green here. This was called the Plymouth Company of the Virginia Company. The red is the London Company of the Virginia Company. So King James, being highly advised, decides to set up a competition. And this is what he said. We're going to have two companies of wealthy merchants who are going to plant colonies in the New World that are supposed to bring back revenue, right, for England. They'll make us wealthy. But you know what? If we only have one company, which would have been King James' idea, you only have one company, you just have a monopoly. But this one, and look at, they overlap here. They're overlapping here. Was supposed to be that whichever was most successful got to plant the second colony in the middle. You follow me? So you had the Plymouth Company and the London Company. They both were set out in 1607. Most people totally don't know this. Two colonies were established in 1607. The Popham Colony, that's what the PO is, the Popham Colony, which is in southern Maine today, and Jamestown, the J. You've all heard about Jamestown, right? Now, Jamestown was established toward the top of this area. And Jamestown, after 13 years, was it producing success? No, not economically. It was not producing success. Up here, the Popham Colony never lasted that long. It lasted only 9 months. And the reason it lasted 9 months was because of the lack of character in the leaders. You had a 57-year-old leader and a 28-year-old leader. The 28-year-old all of a sudden got a letter that came to him and said he'd just become wealthy by the death of some rich uncle, so he leaves. The other 55-year-old guy is too old. He ends up dying. You end up, the whole colony begins to implode. Plus, one thing they felt like, the winter was horrible in New England. It was so bad in New England, they didn't know if anyone could live. But you have to realize that there was a colony that came in Maine. This Popham colony was exactly like Jamestown. They were the plants of the English-style church. It went out of business, which providentially opened up a possibility for another group to come 13 years later. This company had already gone out of business. Why did it go out of business? Government sets supply and demand, right? Goes out of business. And this company would be replaced just before the Pilgrim's sale and give them a patent and give them a contract. But the drama doesn't end there, because the whole idea of whether we're going to have an economic system that allows people to eat the fruit of their doings or whether we're going to have an economic system that is controlled by the state is on the world stage. The world should know by now, the world should, one doesn't work, right? It just doesn't work. It constantly collapses, but they continue on. So now, here's what happens. So the Pilgrim Financial Contract, what do they get from this? They wanted to do it. First of all, they had a solemn day of humiliation to seek the Lord for his direction. Every point the pilgrims would pray. They would get in and spend all day. When they had a prayer meeting, it was not 2 hours. It was 10 hours. And they prayed all day long, did not eat, fasted, humiliation before God, asking God for direction. Now, they came up with this. Now, they've been doing their homework. They said the following. All these other exploring parties, there's one thing, massive thing they lack. None of them bring families. A family is the biggest engine of economic productivity. Remember in Jamestown, last ditch effort? What did they do in 1619? Brought a boatload of women into Jamestown. Imagine, I don't know, ladies, I don't know if you'd want to be one of those ladies. You're single, you're on a big boat, and you're going off, and now you're facing about 60 guys that are choosing you as you walk off that boat. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I would think. I mean, that's not too great. What was the idea for that? The idea was if they get married, they'll stay. If they don't get married, there's no incentive to produce. So, pilgrims wisely said this. If you're 16 or older, you get 100 acres of land. You double your share if you bring provisions. See, the incentive was this. If you went and say, I'm going to go to the New World on this Mayflower expedition, but I'll do the following. Not only am I going to pay, I'll sell my house, sell my farm, sell my cattle, because they were all farmers, and I will get enough money to buy shares. Shares is like a stock company. This is a joint stock company. It's like the stock market. If you buy shares in Sears, not a good place right now, but if you buy stock in other places like that, that are going up, like a tech company, you know what I mean? You buy $100 worth of shares. You know how it operates. If that company makes money, what happens to your share? Goes up, right? You make money if they make money. You're investing in free market economics. That's what this was. You had adventurers that were going to invest. Now, here's what the pilgrims' philosophy was. If we produce enough economic incentive for a man to bring his wife and children, there's two reasons we'll do that. Number one, that's what God says a church is. A church is not just individuals, it's made up of families. And therefore, we're going to have the foundation of the family. If we make the incentive that large, two things are going to happen. You're going to have a number of families that go to the New World. That's not been done. Follow me? That's new. Second, the adventurers, the financiers, the wealthy merchants are going to want to invest, because right now, they're done. You follow me? Their companies are going out of business. Why are we going to finance another failed venture for England to have a colony that only needs more money every year that they'll never be able to pay it back? You follow me? It's a losing adventure. You don't want to do that. So how can we make ourselves attractive to the adventurers? Are you following me? And they'll do it with one fell stroke. We're going to bring our families. And it worked. You know why it worked? First of all, to tell you a quick story. Stephen Hopkins. He's a passenger on the Mayflower, but he's also in Jamestown. Stephen Hopkins went by himself. He left his family, and it's because you couldn't travel by families, and he was on the 1609 shipwreck on Bermuda. You may have read about it. Shakespeare writes his play about it, The Tempest. And you have this, he's on the ship, and he barely lives. Now, his wife and children are back in England, living in a tiny apartment with hardly any provisions. He wants to provide for his family. He sees no economic profit in England. You know why, okay? No economic profit. But I could make a lot of money if I go to one of these colonies, spend 5 years, 5 years without your wife and children, spend 5 to 7 years, and then come back with so much money, I'll bless my family, and we'll live better, and we'll get a new house, and we'll do all this kind of stuff. So Stephen Hopkins, desire for liberty in his family, he nearly drowns, he gets on Bermuda, and then he does something that's kind of strange, at least at the time. The governor on Bermuda says, I am the law. Since there's nobody else, I'm the captain, I'm the law. Stephen Hopkins was the worship leader for the whole boat. He led the Psalms. So he's in the church, he's worshiping. And he said, excuse me, you know, it might be good that we operate a little more balanced with self-government by having a few more people go. Immediately he was charged with mutiny, and he nearly got killed for expressing liberty. Oh my word, this guy's crazy. Well, that's what they thought. He gets to Jamestown. They go through their starving time. 1609, 1610. You know what a starving time is in Jamestown? 600 people to 60. Let me say that again. 600 to 60. Only 60 people left. One of them, Stephen Hopkins. He finally says that this is a total, absolute what? Failure. He gets on a boat and he goes back. Finds out his wife has died. Left the children in the care of somebody else. He finds that. He gets remarried. And he says, I have to make a new start. And all of a sudden, now the time is 1618, 1619. And he hears a rumor that in a small town along the Thames River, near a man who owns a boat, Christopher Jones, the boat's name, the Mayflower, they're having a secret meeting in the basement of the church for a new venture into the world of the wilderness, but this time you bring your family with you. You know what Stephen Hopkins does? He moves heaven and earth, so to speak, to sneak into that meeting. He wants to know, but the moment he says that, he signs on. Stephen Hopkins came on the journey because it was a family. Do you follow me? There's one example. I could tell other stories. But you double your share. If you bring your wife and children, each child 16 and older gets a share, and those 10 to 15, half a share, and anyone under 10, no share but 50 acres. So if I have a baby that's just been born in my family, my wife and I have a baby, that baby can inherit 50 acres of land due to the productivity and the rules for buying the land and whatnot. This is amazing. This is phenomenal. So I bring my family now to the new world. And here's a problem. Weston, who is their financial advisor, is saying, whoa, baby. See, the pilgrims said, we're going to work 5 days for the company. We're going to work 1 day for ourselves. We're going to have 1 day off for the Sabbath to worship God. And we're going to have our own gardens, and we're going to have our own private property, because they had been studying what book? The Bible. And they knew, if you don't have private property, you have no incentive. And Weston says, whoa, wait a second. The financial adventurer said, wait, this is way too much incentive for them. This is violating that. They're committing the sin of profit. So behind their backs, with just the two agents, he changes the contract. And now he says, you have to work 6 days for the company instead of five. That curtailed the family incentive. Now, they're already signed up. Everybody's signed up, ready to go. This is right last second. And yet these families realize it's still better than what it is in England. Diminishes the ability of the planters to pay back the adventurers. By the way, every time you use a false economic system, it comes back to bite you. Come on, adventurers. If you want to be paid back, give them all the incentive they need. The more money they make, guess what? The more money you make. That's why you put shares in that company. If that company makes a ton of money, guess who else makes a ton of money? You do. It's your choice to put it in. You don't have to. And you can pull it out. You can do those things, but After 7 years, the second change, everything was liquidated and evenly distributed to planters and adventurers. So in other words, no matter how much you improve the soil, improve your land, grow crops, send back supplies, and improve your tools, have shipments sent, and everything else, at the end of 7 years, you start to go back to the very scratch, and you simply uniformly liquidate and evenly distribute. Not, no problem. Look, kids leave my class all the time for athletic events. I understand. Win. Will you win one for me? Okay. All right. That's good. Cool. All right. And then, okay, now, so back to this, and I'm going to wrap it up. When I wrap it up, I'm going to ask you a few questions, which I'm sure you'll be able to answer. You guys, what position? You play any position. Oh, that's pretty good. That's good. So after 7 years, you liquidate it. Everybody gets the same. Okay? Everybody gets the same amount. What does that do to incentive, folks? If it didn't matter how much you worked, it didn't matter how many acres you farmed, after 7 years, see, you're going to count very quickly. Why did they do 7 years? This comes from the Bible. You know, you never have, you know, according to biblical law in the Old Testament, you can't have a loan for more than 7 years. And because, and then after 50 years, all loans are paid back with a year of Jubilee, so you recognize it. So nobody's going to loan any money 2 years before the year of Jubilee. Or they're going to do a two-year loan. What it does is keep a cycle and keeps a limit on that. Well, so they have the 7 years, but then the adventurers. See, the adventurers want to make sure the planters, the pilgrims, don't make too much money. But guess who they want to make money? Themselves. They preach that you are sinful to want a profit. But what do they want? The profit so that they can make, they want to make money. They want to make up for all the money they just lost in all the other adventures. So the common field concept was practiced. That's what this means. Common field simply meant this, that we were all living in a town and we all have cattle. But we have only one field. The field is in the center of town. You don't have your own private field. You don't have your own private field. But you do own your cattle. So you have your cattle marked. You know what I mean? You mark your cattle with some way. You know what your cattle is. But the field is common, which means all the cattle graze on the same field. Well, there's a problem. It caused turmoil in all the counties in England that practice it. You know why? Because some cattle are fatter than others. What do you think? Some cattle eat more than others. So what if a cattle, your cattle, man, it grazes from morning till night. Never stops chomping. Your cattle, man, he just eats a little, goes to sleep. Okay? And you are really upset because you got five more cattle, but his cattle eats everything. There's nothing left for your cattle. And so there would be fights between neighbors because the land was held in common. Everybody follow what I'm talking about? The common field concept was considered a disaster. They didn't change it, but it was considered a disaster. That's what the pilgrims had to be enforcing, a common field. Individual productivity incentive was diminished. The pilgrims said this was fitter for thieves and bond slaves than honest men, and they couldn't change it. They were all packed up. They already sold their lands. They were on their way. They'd already come with the Speedwell. They were already in England. Too late to change it. And then here's what happens. The first harvest festival and Thanksgiving, everybody says, well, the pilgrims couldn't be starving. They had that first Thanksgiving in October, probably October, nobody knows the exact date, of 1621. Folks, the only reason that looks good is because the native Indians brought all the food. They bring the five deer. They bring all the stuff to eat, so it looks really good. The pilgrims, look, there's only four adult women alive after the first winter. Imagine four women alive cooking for 90 plus 45, so that's like 135 people for dinner. And there's only, if we had, they couldn't have come up with that food. That was impossible. But then, in 1621, the fortune brings 36 people, but all that the company sent at any time was always too short for those people that came with it. So every time a boatload came to Plymouth, they had no supplies. They're getting worse and worse. They're starving. 1622, Weston proved unfaithful. He didn't deliver supplies. They were not yet well acquainted with Indian corn. They couldn't produce it. So as it will well appear that famine must still ensue, the next year also, if not some way prevented or supply should fail, to which they durst not trust. So in other words, the pilgrim said, look, if this continues, our plantation will fail. Not because of its vision, not because of its mission, because of its economic system. You follow me? We are facing disaster. And so Bradford says this, I cannot trust this false system any longer. And then this is what they do, which I'm sure you've heard about. So they began to think of how much they might raise corn as they could, obtain a better crop than they had done, that they might not still thus languish in misery. The governor, with the advice of the chiefest among them, gave way that they should set corn every man for his own particular, and in that regard trust to themselves, and so assigned every family a parcel of land, according to the proportion of their number. This had very good success. It made all hands very industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise might have been by any means the governor or any other could use. The women now went willingly into the field, took their little ones with them to set corn, which before would allege weakness and inability, whom to have compelled would have been thought a great tyranny and oppression. See, if you forced people to go into the field to work, pilgrims didn't want to do that. They were leaving that kind of oppression. They didn't want that. So what do? If you're stuck in that kind of a situation, what do you do? So the experience that was had in this common course and condition tried sundry years among godly and sober men that the taking away of property and bringing in community into a commonwealth would make them happy and flourishing as if they were wiser than God. See, they knew. They're studying their Bibles. They know that this is not what God set up. So what do? They go from the common field to start private gardens. They start it. They don't complete it, but they do start it. So what lessons can we learn? This is what they say. If you have common ownership of labor or land, people tend to become lazy. What do you think? That true? I said to my students one time, I'm going to give you a test. This is a tough test. You're going to write 15 essays, and you're going to write essays on the common law. It was a constitutional law exam, and I said, and you're going to write on this, and you're going to compare the common law concept under King Alfred with this, and the kids' eyes are rolling back. And I said, it's going to be a tough thing, but never fear. What I'm basically going to do is I'm going to all give you the same grade. So what I've done is I've checked out the last five exams, okay? And I know this class, if I take all your scores and I average them together, it comes out to be about 84.5. That's pretty good. That's pretty high. So 84.5 is the average of the class. So everybody gets an 84.5. Okay? How's that sound? I know what you're going to say, because I have students that look at me and they go, and what would you be shocked if one of the students says, that is just unjust. Is that true? Why? Yeah, what if the kid who gets a 60, is he going to work any harder? No, he automatically gets what? What about the person who gets 100? I would say probably half of my class would still have worked and got 100, even if I had to give them an 84.5. But after about four or five tests, that would not be the case. You know what I mean? Why should I do it? Do you follow me? The incentive doesn't work that way. So when things are distributed equally, quote, rather than individual work ethic, people make excuses not to work. What do you think? Yeah. Communal economics breeds discontent. Welfare must be voluntary and private. That was what they learned. And when equality is defined externally, people are no longer respected for their differences and contributions because everybody just gets the same. And government redistribution diminishes free what? Choice. And this was all contained in Bradford's words. And this is 1623, folks. The Puritans did not bring this to New England. The Pilgrims did. The Puritans still had the same economic system after the Pilgrims arrived. In fact, even though they did change to the right economic system now, all right, they immediately after they changed to private gardens, imagine what they thought, God sent a five-week drought. Allowed it. The Lord seemed to blast it, threaten further and more sore famine, upon which they set apart a solemn day of humiliation to seek the Lord by humble and fervent prayer. And then God gave them a speedy and gracious answer, sweet and gentle showers. The Indian visiting was Habermock. He was so impressed, he got converted. 1623 sets up a village right next to the plantation, and amazingly, they had to learn this. Even if you have the right system, if you don't have the right heart, it's still not going to work. It's not just about making money, folks. It's about your attitude to serve with the money you do make. And so God completes this. Powerful lessons here. What's the result? Each family was at least able, at last, to own its own land, keep its own production. The result, tripling the best previous outlook. Look at how much they planted year by year. 1621, 26 acres. 1622, 60 acres. But 1623, after they changed, how many? 184. Wow, the production was amazing. Did they ever pay off the investors? Yeah. Do you know that the investors or the adventurers were so nasty that during these years, they upped the interest payment, even though the pilgrims were up as high as 37%. 37%. They were soaking them. Look, most people just said, hey, you guys, go take a hike. There's nothing you can do. We got 2,500 miles of ocean in between us and you. You go ahead and do what you want for us, and our cannon will be waiting for you. You know what I mean? Have a nice life. We're not paying you back. You guys are corrupt. You say we shouldn't have a profit motive when you've got one. What's wrong with you? They didn't do that. They said their word was gold because they were Christians. They were very innovative. In 1627, they bought the adventurers out. They say they had 7 years. So in 7 years, they bought out the adventurers. They had to pay 1,800 pounds and a plan of 200 pounds per year. They took a loan from the adventurers to get them off their back. Say, we'll pay you back. We don't want to do this anymore. They built a trading post right here. It's the restructured trading post. I don't know, you guys go to that when you go up there? Oh, man, that's the gold of this area. Let me know when you're coming. I'll get you in. But the thing is this. The Uptuxet Trading Post, they had trade. This was free trade. This was 1627. This is what allowed them to pay off their debt. And this is what allowed them to do it. This was ingenious. Now they're under a free market. They're not under this thing anymore. They can do what they want. So they build a trading post right where the natives always come, and the Dutch. Now, how do you do this? Well, you can barter. So the pilgrims come down with some tools from England. Hey, and you want them? You know, I have to find something that's valuable that you want, right? And we can trade. That doesn't always work. So they created a currency, ingeniously. They created a currency called wampum from the quahog shell. Two colors, purple and white. Purple is worth three times the white. And they put them in beads. Now, the currency alone was valuable because it could allow you to trade more equitably. But here's the beauty of it. Now, if you go to the Uptuxet Trading Post, we'll show you some original wampum. We'll show you exactly how they used it, and it made the natives wealthy. Who can catch a quahog faster? Dutch, English, or native? Native. See, the individuality of gifts comes out. Native can get that quahog, and they will fine-tune it. And you know what the native would do? They'd just go for the purple. It's worth three times as much. They'd go get it, and it takes work. We're talking hours and hours and hours to scrape it out of the quahog shell, turn it and mold it, put it into a bead, and then go in and sell it as currency. It's mining gold from the earth. That's what it's doing. And you're creating it. And that's what they did. And the natives, it was a booming business. And the original foundation was left and restored more than 100 years ago. So phenomenal place. And of course, the Jenny builds the grist mill outside the palisade walls, could set his own prices for corn. Do you see the free market starting to work? And this is how they paid off their debt. But what year did it take them to pay it off? 1642. Whew. But I tell you, the testimony is they paid it off, which is unheard of at the time. Now, we'll just talk about the Puritan, and I'm going to open it up for some questions and see what you would like to do or ask anything about this. The failure of the Puritan economics. I don't know if you go to the Saugus Ironworks part of your tour. Well, it's an interesting one because it is, if I go there and do a tour, I'll say you can look at the original Saugus Ironworks. It's like a factory produced by the Puritans. And this was to make iron. I gave you an illusion of that. But here's the problem. They were under the Puritan economic system. I mean, English economic system. Did they make money? No. Listen to what Governor Winthrop said. The court having found by experience that it would not avail by any law to redress the excessive rates of laborers and worksmen's wages. for being restrained, they would either remove to other places where they might have more, or else being able to live by planting of other employments on their own, and they would not be hired. The people who worked, and they said, I have to make more wages. But could you pay them more? Even the good workers, you were not allowed to. So what happened? The workers leave. They're going to go where they can make more money. It was therefore referred to the several towns to set the rates among themselves. So what are the Puritans learning? You can't do it this way. The free market must set it. This took better effect so that in a voluntary way, by the counsel and persuasion of the elders, example of some who led the way, they were brought to more moderation than they could by compulsion, but it held not long, which meant it went out of business in 1670. So none of the big companies could last unless they had a stream of wealth coming from the outside that had nothing to do with their productivity. Okay, tell me, what stands out in your mind that I've taught? What one thing would you remember?
Free market's better.
Free market's better. Okay, why? Let me go a little deeper. All right, so it demands a better work ethic, doesn't it? Because if you don't work, you're not going to eat, like the Bible says. Someone else, what stands out in your mind?
Mm-hmm. The whole basis of like economics is that in the Garden of Eden was all laid out from the beginning of time. Everything was laid out just in those
few. Okay, so in the Garden of Eden, it was laid. I'm just repeating it because I think this is being recorded. It's being laid out in the Garden of Eden. All right, so we have no excuse if we study the Bible. All right, somebody else. What stands out? Yes, go ahead.
The first law was the law of liberty.
The first law was the law of liberty. That's good. In the Garden of Eden, you're free to eat how many of the trees?
All of them but one.
About one. So freedom's never absolute. What else? What else do you remember? Any examples? Anything the pilgrims did that's worth remembering? Right, and you can produce it, and not everybody has the same likes. They're not going to always do that. Do you know there are differences between pizza shops, though there are pizza shops everywhere? How many know pizza is fairly popular, right? You can find a pizza shop. But how many know that pizza shops are not all the same? Would you agree? If someone asked you, you'd say, oh, no, let's go to this place. They make the best pizza. Because you see, people are very different. They're just not the same. They're not cookie cutter. So good point. Somebody else? Yeah, go ahead.
The pilgrims proved that a free market society when it comes to economics is more profitable for a work ethic and production. I would say production of goods. Because they have the incentive to work in a more free market society that people determine how much they should pay or whatever.
All right, good. Anyone else? Think of anything that you remember? Oh, you got to remember something. You can't let me down, man. Anything? See, I'm used to calling on people. Don't know your name, but, you know. Any thoughts?
They made their own money.
They made their own money. They mined their own money. Yep. And it became valuable. Because remember, the value is in its use. It's internal. So it's not set by the government, is it? The Pilgrim government did not set the value of wampum. You know who set the value of wampum? The natives. Because they could produce it so fast. Go ahead.
How the Pilgrims were much more likely to leave when they had a reason, they had their families. When they had a reason to stay there, they were much more likely to stay.
Yeah, they're much more likely to come with families. What do you think, if you're the age you are now, and your families decide to get on a boat that does not normally carry people, it only carries produce, you have a 50% chance of dying on the voyage or in the first year you're there. Very few people come back. It's an adventure, almost desperate. I mean, would you be like, come on, get me on the boat? Or, Dad, Mom, you're crazy. I think I will stay in England. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of commitment from the mothers, especially. Women never traveled on boats. And young men sometimes did. But women did not. And they knew that there was, I'm not telling, it's probably more than 50%. rate that you just weren't going to come back. And then, you know, what do you do on board the ship for 66 days while it's rocking and water's all over the place and you're sick, everybody's coughing and spitting up and, you know, yikes. I won't go into more detail how everything's stored on there, but still, it's like, man, it's no joke. They had to have a thought of the future. They had to have, which they did. And not easy. So good. No other questions? Now listen, let me ask you, I don't know how much you've had, but this mini little picture of the pilgrims and their economic seed, it wasn't, they still had the common field after they did it. They didn't fully change everything. They were taking one step at a time. It was a first step process. It ended up being the economic system enshrined in our Constitution. Do you know that? Our Constitution had our Constitution actually had clauses. I'll just do one thing, and then I know we're out of time, so I'll turn this over in a minute. But do you know that we had four clauses in our Constitution that correspond to the economic freedom formula in the Garden of Eden? That everyone has to play by the same rules, so nobody can be played favorite by the government. There are copyrights and patents so that you have a natural monopoly on your production of tools. You protect private contracts. So if you make a contract with him, you go into business together, and you decide, hey, we're different, you know. I love taking care of books. You love getting out with people. You know, you're on the front steps, man. You'll pull them in. And you're like, hey, great, let's work together. You make a contract. The government is not allowed to come in and meddle with that contract. That's between two people. The government stays out of it. See, that's part of the economic freedom formula. Do you think we follow this today? No. These things are violated all the time. Protect laws on how to fail. The Constitution gives you freedom to fail. That's why you can file a bankruptcy. So when all the car makers in Detroit went out of business, a former president says, I bailed out the car companies. What's bailout mean? You're not free to fail. And so we have it in the Constitution, the actual economic freedom formula is protected, as well as the new wampum, which was coins. So the government was never to make money. The government only coined the money you made. So you go in the mine, you risk your life, you go down deep, you go a mile underground, you pull that gold out, you melt it all down, then you take it to the government foundry. You follow me? And they put it into coins. So the government never makes money off of your money. It only coins it for circulation. You see? You think that's where, so we've made a lot of gold and silver, haven't we, to have all these $1 trillion spending bills to bail people out? No. Well, all right, thank you. Thank you for being attentive. I know it's tough. It's the afternoon. I'm just a big pilgrim, but thank you very much for all that.